I've noticed that parents will never admit that their child needs help, or loved ones will never admit that their child needs help. They'll always say things like, he can do it, or she can do it, she should learn from their other siblings. Why aren't they learning, or why aren't they just getting a job? So I've noticed that it's taken me quite a long time to convince some parents to say, this is an addiction problem which you need to understand.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Global Health Unfiltered podcast, a podcast about unspoken realities of global health in Africa and the world. I'm your host, Desmond Jumbam, and I'm joined today by a very special guest, a new face and a new voice to the Global Health Unfiltered team. I'm joined by Chisomo Mwale, who has been a part of the team for a while, and she will be co-hosting with me today. Hi, Chisomo.
Hi, Des. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good to see you.
Good to see you too.
So, did you know that over 100 million people in Africa suffer from a mental health condition? And according to UNICEF, about 65% of young people with mental health condition do not seek the help they need. Suicide is the ninth most common cause of death among adolescents between the ages of 15 and 19 years of age in Africa. So today we'll be tackling this topic, this mammoth of a topic of mental health in Africa. And this is a topic that we've wanted to cover on the podcast for a long time. And we're joined by a very special guest from Zambia who will be sharing her expertise and her experience on the topic with us. But before we get to our guests, we'd like to share some exciting news with all of you. I know it's been a while since we've uploaded an episode, but there's a reason for that. We've been very busy in the background. We have now launched a new website called globalhealthunfiltered.com. And on globalhealthunfiltered.com, you'll find various resources. You can listen to the latest episodes of Global Health Unfiltered. You can share your comments and engage with other listeners on that website. But the other thing that you'll find on the website is a blog. So we've launched the Global Health Unfiltered blog. And this is a resource that we're providing to all of you, our listeners, and to anyone who is interested in sharing their views, sharing their opinions and their insights on various topics that we cannot cover on the podcast, right? So feel free to submit ideas, submit your opinions about trending global health issues on the continent and globally. And you can find the instructions for that on globalhealthunfiltered.com. And finally, we'd like to thank you, as always, for supporting the podcast. And if you'd like to make a donation to the podcast, we now have a resource for you to do that. And again, you can find it on the podcast, on the website, globalhealthunfiltered.com. You can make a one-time donation or subscribe to be a regular monthly donor to the website to get access to exclusive content. So just go to globalhealthunfiltered.com. Thank you very much, and we're always grateful for your support. And now to our guest.
Okay, so today we are joined by Safira Muntali Mulemba. As a mental health practitioner, Safira has over 11 years experience implementing mental health clinical trials in Zambia as a project manager with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg Public Health Team and Center for Infectious Disease Research in Zambia. Currently, she is part of the Social Science Humanitarian Action Platform Fellowship Program as a social scientist. Safira is affiliated with the Global Mental Health Action Network and has a track record of impact as a Zambian therapist, a mental health advocate, and mental health implementation manager. Safira currently works with the Center for Infectious Disease Research in Zambia. Thank you so much for joining us today, Safira, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So just to start, can you please tell us what drew you to working in mental health?
That's it. Yeah. So I think when I was doing my bachelor's degree, I did social work. I think what I saw with social work was I loved working with people. I loved working with kids and the vulnerable people in general. So in our second year, we had to do practicals. So I was given a case, and that was a GBV case, which resorted to divorce anyway. So what I was facilitating was the woman taking custody of the children. So I think during that process, I discovered that I got so much interest in knowing their both couple, their history, their lifestyle, and what could have led to divorce. And it was quite a horrible experience. So the wife talked to me about how she was sexually abused. She was in a foster home care, and the people that were taking care of her, the foster dad raped her several times. The foster brother raped her several times. She was moved from that foster home to another foster home. So it was like a series of sexual abuse. Until she was 17, she ran away. Somehow along the way, she met this man who she fell in love with. They got married, they had kids. But what she talked about was her experience sort of affected her relationship with her ex-husband at the time. And to a certain degree, she blamed him for not understanding her. But he was like, I can't deal with this because these are unresolved issues, and eventually it affected their relationship. So I think interacting with her, and she got into substance use as well in the process. So interacting with her got me thinking about, I felt at that point, I felt I needed to help her, but I didn't know how, and I didn't know what to do. So just from my own instincts, I would just talk to her, be available and be there. And, you know, at some point, I think I remember when I was graduating, she kept in touch. She left for the UK. She started her own life there, and she seemed to be doing better. And she would write to me from time to time, just telling me how my interaction with her, in as much as I was young, I was really young at the time, and they were like in their 30s. I was like maybe 22. Still helped them, because I remember the husband saying, what do you know about marriage? You're just very young. But I was, you know, I managed to still work with them, and eventually he got the kids, but she started her own life. And not only that, obviously there've been other events in my life that have happened in my personal life. There's been substance use in my family. There's been addiction in my family, and dealing with that has sort of driven me to really advocate and really talk about mental health and try to help as much as I can with my background, as well as experience with work. So I think that is where it really stemmed from. I think it's that particular case that kind of triggered that I can actually do it. And I do get people naturally just opening up to me. They come to me, they talk to me. And I feel like maybe this is what I need to be doing. And it feels good. I feel fulfilled when I actually help. So, yeah, some of those experiences led me to really focus on mental
health. Wow. And this is, you know, for Alyssa, I'm guessing this is happening in Zambia.
So, sorry. So I should have mentioned this. I did my bachelor's degree in Namibia. So that's Namibia. Southern Africa region, yeah. But yeah, so that's where this situation happened. However, I'm in Zambia. I'm working in Zambia now. So everything that I'm doing right now is Zambia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And you know, it's quite a powerful story how you saw this need and you decided that you are going to do something about it. Can you tell us what that process of doing something about it looked like for you, right? You know, when you saw this woman, or you saw the pain in your family, right? How did you decide to take action?
Yeah, so one of the things, I think I'm quite proactive in reacting to people's requests or experiences. I think, and I think it's a natural thing. I won't say everybody has it. I think it's natural for me to just respond. And I think and as I mentioned, something happened to me when I was exposed to this particular case. And I just wanted to stop her crying. For her to stop crying, I wanted to take that pain away. And one of the things that I did was I would encourage her, for example, on positive things. So I was talking about cognitive distortions in our culture earlier. I was sharing with Chisomo. What is it that you can do today? Yes, you have been sexually abused. We're not taking that away. You have lost your marriage, but you're alive. And you still have a life, you're a beautiful woman, you're still young, you can still meet someone. And with that process, for me, it was spending time on a weekly basis with her. So I would go to the park, I would sit with her, I would take notes, I would ask her what she's feeling like on that day, what she wanted to talk about, and I would just take down these notes. And obviously, with the emphasis of confidentiality. And through that process of just listening, and sitting there and not passing judgment, not giving her advice, but really just listening to her and asking her what she could do within her space that she was capable of doing. Because at that time, I felt like I didn't have the actual tools that I probably have now. So I would always ask her, so what is it that you can do? Who do you trust in your family that you can talk to if you feel like smoking and drinking? What about your kids? If you hold your babies, does that help? So we would always explore with what she already had within her means. So that way I found it easier, because at the time I was just a student, and obviously I didn't have the confidence I have now. So that's one of the things I did for that particular case. And when we talk about now, because of my experience, because of my work, and just to go back a little bit, when I came back to Zambia, I just saw myself as a therapist. I'm going to try and just work with people with GBV cases, sexual abuse cases. But then being hired I started off as a monitoring and evaluation officer, where I would collect data and really look at the data. It was boring for me. I think I didn't like the actual M&E work. So I remember speaking to one of the PIs on the study, and I said, I really like organizing. I really like arranging things. I really like to see things happen. Collecting data is like you're just like looking at your laptop and you have these numbers. And so I was like, this is not my thing. I think I want to try. So I want to do something that I love to do. I love to interact with people. So I was actually moved positions to project manager. And I found that position for me gave me the opportunity to organize, to really link people to services. So even though I couldn't see that case because of confidentiality and the position that I'm in, I would always go and look for people that can handle cases, and I would always triage kind of thing. So that's what I still do even now. So people will still come to me, they'll call me, you are known for this. Can you help? If I can't deal with that case immediately, right, I'll ask them, do they prefer to be seen by someone? And I'll kind of link them to resources services that are available.
Wow. So you're doing, some research.
Yes, I'm doing research.
And I'm cute. That's your day to day. That's your focus,
yes, that's
which
what
is
I'm
which
hired
is
for.
Amazing. Because, okay.
Yes.
Well,
but
I there,
my
there
background,
is there is
is in
therapy. The reason I say that is because, you know, we've heard a bit more over the years about the issues of mental health in Africa and the predominance of that, but what are the actual numbers? You know, do you know? Can you tell us the current burden, the current state of mental health in Africa, and perhaps even more specific to Zambia, where you work? What are the mental health burden, the challenges that you see?
Yeah, so according to Strong Minds, WHO, for Africa right now, they've reported 85% of adolescents, to be more specific, are struggling from mental health problems. But in regards to Zambia itself, it's interesting. We had a national mental health meeting over the same. So what is happening, and I could be moving on to the next question as well, but what's happening is we need to do a mapping to know who's actually doing what. So we're seeing a lot of numbers, but we don't see the evidence-based kind of interventions that are happening or research programs that are happening. So It's hard to actually say the actual numbers, but so far I'm basing this information from Strong Minds. They're saying it's 85%, which is really high for adolescents. But in reality, I don't know, I would be lying. And we're actually working on all coming together as stakeholders and really looking at what work are we doing that's research evidence-based and we publish. So if WHO says Zambia, for example, has 75% of adolescents or adults, young adults suffering from this, we should be able to have that backing and we should be able to agree, because at the moment it's very hard. I've been doing research and there's been so much data that we have, but I'm just not sure how much that data has gone out there really to inform Zambians, and it's pretty much really our fault. But I think those are the conversations we're having right now to really start mapping and putting data together so we can communicate the same way.
Wow. Yeah, thank you so much for that insight. It's really difficult to, like you said, to put numbers to it, because for the longest time, mental health hasn't really been talked about. The next question now is related to COVID-19. You know, it's something that's been talked about quite extensively, especially with people having to go into isolation and having to be away from loved ones. It really, we saw a lot of mental health crises just spike up across the pandemic. But specifically to Zambia, how did the pandemic affect mental health in Zambia?
So there was definitely a huge need for interventions, because I remember Ministry of Health, this is Lusaka, LPHO reaching out to us to really use our interventions in, number one, caring for the frontliners, for example. We were overwhelmed. That's number one. The frontliners needed support. They were overwhelmed. People were dying. They themselves were dying. So there were no services. So we definitely were overwhelmed from the frontliners' point of view. And then there was so much anxiety among Zambians as well, because number one, they didn't even understand what this COVID is. There were so many myths going around. And one of the things I remember being in the communities, Ngombe community in Lusaka, in asking participants on our study what their perceptions were around COVID. And one of the things they talked about, not only one, but one of the things they were saying, which was quite significant to me, was they looked at it as a sexually transmitted disease, and that affected the home. So if a partner, one of the partners was found with COVID, they looked at it as a sexual, they got it from someone through sex, the kind of thing. And that increased IPV in homes as well. So intimate partner violence. And then also, I don't have the actual data on the kids as well, how it affected the kids. But what I know is for substance use, there was problems in terms of how to get access to services during the time of isolation. How the hospitals were overwhelmed. So how do people move from their homes to the clinic to get treatment for psychosis due to alcohol? You know, there were those challenges. And financially, that was a huge thing. A lot of people lost jobs. There were a lot of financial, a lot of people lost their jobs. A lot of people lost their businesses. So that did affect us in a horrible way. And then there was also loneliness. I think that was triggered. Suicide cases. I saw a huge rise number of suicide cases. You open Facebook, there was a suicide case. It's hard to tell that was COVID related, but I think at that time there was just so much anxiety going on. So yeah, those were really major issues. And economic wise, we were struggling from it. And sadly, we didn't have enough awareness on COVID, what it was, why are you wearing masks, vaccines. We didn't have so much information on it. So I still think it still poses a problem, but definitely a lot better than the time when it just started. And there was stigma as well, I must say, for those that had COVID, because I remember myself when walking into a mall, just a sneeze, a cough, you'd literally see people run away from you type of thing. So that was huge. So it was hard for you to say you have COVID. It was hard for you to be around your loved ones. So that was very, very difficult, actually. It was actually lonely. It was a very lonely period.
Yeah, I think loneliness is definitely a thing that many people struggled with during COVID.
Yeah.
You know, if I can share a bit of my own experience. You know, when COVID started, you know, I was in Ghana, and you know, about a week after the government's imposed the lockdowns, you know, I found out that my dad had been killed in Cameroon. I unfortunately couldn't go to Cameroon to be with my family and to mourn with them, and so I remained in Ghana, and it was a very difficult time. You know, I think it's one thing to be alone and to be lonely during COVID, not being around people, but I really struggled with grieving alone. And that really messed with my mental health. I found myself really struggling and feeling very depressed and struggling to get out of bed. And even the friends that I had in Ghana couldn't come visit me because of those lockdowns. And so so it was a very, very difficult thing to cope with. And I'm not sure exactly how I coped with it, but I think one of the things that helped was to be able to access a mental health therapist. I was fortunate that there was a mental health therapist that was able to come to my house, you know, with mask and, you know, social distancing, because I really needed it. But that's a big challenge across the continent. It's just that there are not enough mental health therapists, right? And so during COVID, one of the things that came about was telehealth therapy, right? And I know that you've just published a paper on what you guys did to address some of these barriers, the limited number of therapists during COVID, but also the challenges that patients face. Can you tell us a little bit about that paper?
Yeah, so for your information, I really love qualitative work. So yeah, so this paper, I wrote it during the time of COVID. So just to go back a little bit on what I was talking about earlier, when we were asked to provide services to the frontliners as well as the people in the communities, when I was getting the information on them believing that this is a sexually transmitted disease, at that time we were actually implementing telehealth. We had immediately switched to using, instead of in person, we switched to using telehealth, and we didn't do it as a study at the time. It was just a service delivery for us. So I got interested in for people to share what their experience was using telehealth, and these are the providers, but the AYAs. So these are the adolescents and young adults that were on our study. So I got interested in just really understanding what their perceptions were using telehealth. And to be honest, I think for adolescents, number one, to get them on the phone to talk to a stranger, I don't know about other places, but I think it would be a struggle. But they did seem to appreciate it. Some of the results from that paper do say that they do actually prefer having an in-person as an introduction and then moving on to telephone sitter. And the other thing they also appreciate is you won't be able to get COVID because obviously you're using the phone and you're saving costs on traveling. You don't have to travel to see your therapist. It's convenient. You can be called at any time. And interestingly, relationships were built over the phone. So I remember vividly on my phone when I was talking to one of the clients, and she says to me, you know, just the way you sound on the phone, on the other side, you sound very nice, you sound very calm, you sound very engaging, and you seem to really care about my problems. So you could see that even with during that time, relationships were still built between the providers and the clients themselves. So that was something that was really highlighted. And of course, there were challenges to do with, we had electricity issues. This is load shedding. So if your phone is not charged, your session won't happen. Sometimes not all clients had phones, given the population that we're working with. These are young adults, vulnerable. They don't have personal resources to buy their own phones. So, yeah, so they were relying on either caregivers to provide them phones. So what we did was we at least bought phones for sites where we were working from, and a client would go have a session and go back. But again, even that wasn't very sustainable. But for that period of time, we had to make it work. So, yeah, so those were some of the challenges. And of course, they do... Some recommendations are, if it's feasible and acceptable, to actually provide phones in future for our clients to use for this to work. But overall, it was really appreciated. And at the time, I think it was appreciated only also because we needed to see patients somehow. We needed to make it work. And patients also appreciated to be seen, given the circumstances like you just shared. A lot of them had that experience. So having someone speak to them on the phone was a really big deal. It was definitely a big deal and really well appreciated.
Yeah, wow. Thank you so much for that, Safira. I know you had mentioned, you had used the abbreviation CETA, which stands for Common Elements Treatment Approach. Could you just, tell us a little bit about that, and then even going further to your intervention, are there any plans to upskill it in the future?
Okay, so the simplest way I can share about CETA is CETA stands for Common Elements Treatment Approach. This is a transdiagnostic method of providing services. So what this means when I say transdiagnostic is it looks at various mental health problems in one packaging. So you don't have to, so for example, if you're depressed, you don't have to go to see a depressed or a psychiatric who specializes in depression. So it looks at trauma, depression, substance use, stress, anxiety, and I think I mentioned depression. So it treats all that, and it's really tailored to what at that particular time you've come to report. So if you see a provider who's been trained in CETA, if you go to them, you have trauma, or is it grief and loss, or is it, they'll treat that for that particular issue. So it's a very good intervention, which has been used over the last 10 years in different countries, and Zambia is one of them. Trials have been done, and the one last trial that we did before the one we're doing now was on IPV among couples that struggled from substance use, and it worked really well. And interestingly, both men and women really appreciated it and suggested that it should be implemented in other places, not just where we were. And in regards to what we're doing now, so we're looking at telehealth, tele-sita and in-person. So we're trying to compare between the two, which one is more effective in reducing mental health symptoms. We're also looking, it's a TTT, train the trainers. So we have 5 trainers that are being trained to train counselors. So counselors are delivering it to our AYAs. So we're looking at the competency of how competent are these people, how competent are these providers to provide telehealth or in person. And there's a bunch of outcomes, but there's also the cost effectiveness we're looking at. So how cost effective is telehealth CETA, or how cost effectiveness is it to deliver? So we're hoping the results can be very positive so that we upscale, because the plan is to really upscale in the health facilities. Right now we're partnered with NGOs in providing telehealth CETA and in person. So everybody seems, so far that we're working with, seem to really like it. So our hope is, if it works, the results show that it works, then we definitely want to upscale it in other places, because we've trained about 46 providers in different sites. There's about five sites. Mm-hmm. So that's good enough to sort of like start training others in future. I'm hoping that's the plan. So yeah, so once these results come out, we'll definitely love to see it grow to other places. But CETA is being globally used. You can actually look up CETA Globe. It's actually widely used right now. The team, the owners of CETA are in Ukraine. They're in different countries doing the same. So,
Well, it's quite impressive, the work that you're doing in terms of getting this care to people who would otherwise not access it for, you know, one barrier or another. And they're also doing training of the trainers. So they go and train the others. But we can't really talk about mental health in Africa without talking about the stigma around it. I know you mentioned it earlier, but many people still believe that there's no such thing as mental health problems in Africa. There's no depression, there's no anxiety. These are all white people problems. These are problems of the West, right? Can you tell us if this is a challenge that you face in your work, where people who obviously need help refuse the help because they don't think that Africans can suffer from mental health problems?
Yes, 100% true. Like to start with family, you know, there is an addiction problem, you request, can you please see? And one of the things we've seen is stigma is a huge issue. So stigma, not only from the actual person struggling from it, but families as well. So you find, and this has been a common experience for me the last years that I've been working. I've noticed that parents will never admit that their child needs help. Or loved ones will never admit that their child needs help. They'll always say things like, he can do it or she can do it. She should learn from their other siblings. Why aren't they learning? Or why aren't they just getting a job? So I've noticed that it's taken me quite a long time to convince some parents to say, this is an addiction problem which you need to understand. And I think on the provider's side, what the challenge is, we can't force you to come for therapy. We can't force you to go to rehab. We've left it to, it's your own decision. And I think in that, it's harder to actually get help even when there is a problem. It's very hard because we've left it for you to make a decision to go and seek for that help. So the stigma is definitely a big deal. And people don't generally believe that these are Zambian problems or these are African problems. Number one, what a religious culture. So number one, it's going to be either witchcraft or no, let's just go to prayers. So that again is very difficult to unlearn, and not that it's a bad idea to go to church or go to your witch doctor. It's been practiced back in the day anyways. But I think we need a lot of awareness around what mental health is to begin with and what it means. And I think it's easier for me to learn because I've been exposed to this. But for somebody who has not been exposed to mental health work, they will not understand what it is. Even when you talk about psychosis, what is that? They will not understand anxiety, that this is actually anxiety. A lot of it is witchcraft or just go to a pastor. They'll pray for you, take these herbs and all these things. So we're still not very familiar. There's still literature that needs to be done. There's still community engagement that needs to be done. We need stakeholders, and the stakeholders I'm talking about are the people on the ground, the people that we are calling clients, the people that we're calling vulnerable. They need to be more engaged, because one of the challenges is we have all these amazing interventions, but when we are making or coming up with these ideas to implement, we're not engaging. So culturally, it becomes difficult for you to convince someone that they're depressed. So I think a needs assessment in our community is needed. You go and ask, what are the problems here? So you find they'll tell you it's money, you know, and it's true, it's money. So how do you then convince them that, you know, actually you have also, you know, this trauma, this is trauma, sexual abuse is trauma. So you see, there are people who've built resilience, there are people who are coping. So it's still going to be a challenge as long as we don't have resources, budgets for mental health, as long as we don't have capacity, we haven't trained enough people to go out there and learn, and as long as we're not engaging with our communities or stakeholders in what we're thinking as, you know, policymakers or, you know, the managers of these interventions. Yeah.
Well, yeah, what you just mentioned has actually brought up some memories from my childhood. I remember being told that somebody that suffers from depression is just weak, and, you know, all these things that can be quite hurtful and harmful. And I think in my own experience, it's taken a lot of conversations, being vulnerable, sharing and listening to others. And so I think the last question we have for you is, you know, do you have any advice on how we can initiate these conversations about mental health so that we destigmatize them, especially, you know, if it's with older generations that may not necessarily understand or may not necessarily be open to these conversations?
Yeah, I think we need to build mental health in our curriculums. I think that's quite important as well. So education system, they have to include mental health from a younger stage. We need to. So it's really creating all these spaces. So number one, like this podcast is one of the spaces where conversations like this can happen, more of this type of things. Like I mentioned, schools as well, from a tender age, really helping kids identify what certain things could mean. If they're feeling some type of way, they're feeling suicidal, there was COVID, a lot of people have lost loved ones, how to deal with grief. If we have resources and budgets to really implement, you know, more trained mental health specialists, make it available, like include it in our education system. Like people should specialize in mental health and really just tailor it to your culture. So what works for you might not work for another culture. So having platforms and having, I would say, policymakers, but I always feel like, and I like policy, but I would like to see policymakers really come on our level. I feel like there's a level of people that have access to policies and they understand that side of things, but a lay person, they won't understand that there's actually a policy that, you know, has all these guidelines for mental health. So really starting it from schools, getting it into our homes, and if it's getting it into our homes, it's through support groups, churches. I think churches should start really talking about mental health, really. I know it's religion, could be going against things, but I think problems are happening, so they need to be highlighted in a way that still does not change the religious system, but really talking about them in smaller groups, just for awareness sake and really understanding what this mental health is. Because I feel like there's so many people talking about it, but there's a lack of backing on what people understand. And there's so many people coming up with NGOs, treatment centers, and they're not actually treating people because they don't have the expertise. So yeah, we do definitely need resources. We need more training, capacity needs to be built, and more evidence-based for people to believe that there's a problem.
Well, thank you very much, Safira. Thank you for coming on the Global Health Unfiltered podcast and for sharing your insights. And thank you for the amazing work that you're doing in Zambia. Really appreciate it and look forward to having you again soon.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for this opportunity. Yeah.
This episode of Global Health Unfiltered was brought to you with support from the Decolonizing and Global Health Research Exchange Network. We're very grateful for their support in this episode. If you would like to make a donation and support the podcast, you can do this through a one-time donation through our website, globalhealthunfiltered.com, or you can also subscribe to receive exclusive content every month from Global Health Unfiltered. Thank you very much for joining us, and see you next time. Thank you, Chisomo.
Thank you, Des. Thank you, everyone.